Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo, Jill Robbins, Jonathan Evans, and Ashley Thompson. But first, this report. For generations, many colleges and universities in the United States have offered classes in a lot of different subjects. Higher education officials believed that by learning about different subjects, students would be able to improve their understanding of the world around them. But a new study suggests the current generation of college students may not value liberal arts study programs as much as earlier generations. It found many current students want programs that directly connect to specific career paths. In November 2019, the social research company Gallup and the Strata Education Network reported on an opinion study of 340,000 Americans. Researchers asked the individuals about their educational experiences after high school. They wanted to know if these men and women felt whatever classes or study programs they attended were worth the cost. Out of those who completed a vocational program, meaning training for a specific job or technical skill, 57% strongly agreed it was worth the cost. However, only 40% of people who completed four-year study programs at a traditional college or university said the same.
Dave Clayton is a senior vice president with Strata. He told VOA the study confirms earlier findings from his organization. He said it shows that Americans want higher education to relate to jobs. In the past, many Americans thought of higher education as a means or method of self-improvement, Clayton says. A college or university was traditionally a place for improving one's critical thinking and other skills by learning about different subjects. So while students would focus on one central subject, like economics, they might also take classes in literature or philosophy, for example. But the cost of U.S. higher education has risen over the past 30 years, notes Clayton. And the labor market has changed a great deal. More than ever before, higher education has become a requirement for better paying jobs. Yet employees can no longer expect to work for the same company for many years, and may even need to change fields more than once. So, Clayton argues, people want to gain demonstrable skills that have some kind of long-lasting value. This is especially important to many Americans with limited financial resources. We have expanded access to college over the generations, and so the upward social mobility that can provide becomes even more important for those communities who are trying to break through or advance their lives, Clayton said.
But this questioning of the value of a liberal arts education is nothing new, even if it feels like a modern concern, notes Timothy Burke. He is a co-director of the Adelot Foundation at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. The foundation researches and provides support to liberal arts programs. Burke notes that while America's first colleges were teaching students subjects like Latin and history, their students wanted to learn how to become doctors or engineers. However, even the biggest companies today are not just looking for students with one area of specialization. In 2010, Steve Jobs, creator of Apple, stated that technology alone is not enough. It's technology married with liberal arts that yields the results that make our hearts sing, he said. Similarly, another technology company, Google, led a study of its own leadership team in 2008. The aim was to identify the top 10 qualities possessed by its most successful and effective executives. It listed strong communication and leadership abilities well above technical skills. Many people around the world still see the U.S. liberal arts approach to higher education as among the best in the world, Burke says. In fact, the number of colleges and universities following this model has grown in Asia and Europe in recent years.
Still, Burke argues, the problem remains that liberal arts programs do not do a good job of explaining to the public where their value lies. Even if there's actually a lot of evidence, it's not anything that relieves anybody's anxiety, especially in a time when a lot of Americans fear, with some good reason, that overall the next generation will not do better than their parents did financially, which is a new situation in American history, he said. Burke suggests the way forward is not necessarily to get liberal arts educators to change what they are teaching. Instead, they need to change how they teach by making connections between the material they present in classes and issues in the real world. That will help students better understand how they can put what they are learning to use. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. Rats. They are not among nature's most loved animals. However, rats help humans in many ways. They have been tested and retested for so many diseases and other issues, all for the purpose of human health and happiness. Rats have other uses as well. For example, they can be trained to find explosives buried underground. Despite all this, lots of people fear or even hate rats. So some people like rats, some don't. However, when talking about English expressions, rat phrases almost all have a negative meaning. Calling someone a rat is a big insult. When we rat on someone, we tell others something they did in order to get them in trouble. If an object is ratty, it is in poor condition. And we can simply say rats if something bad happens. Today, we will talk about another bad rat expression, rat race. This may sound like a running contest between rats. It is not. A rat race is a purely human situation. If you are in a rat race, you are in a daily work routine that is extremely competitive, tiring, and never-ending. Day after day, you compete for more power and more wealth against others wanting the same thing. We can also use the term rat race to describe a person's struggle to gain the basics of life. This struggle is also out of their control. They are seemingly helpless against a way of life that is slowly killing them and their soul. Some word historians say this expression comes from real rat races. These were sporting events held in the 1800s. People would bet money on the rats. Others say it comes from the custom of testing rats in laboratory experiments. Scientists often study rats to see how they will react in different conditions. During some of these experiments, scientists put rats in cages. They give them a winding path or maze to run. As the rats look for the reward, in many cases a piece of cheese, researchers place many obstacles in their way. The rat's race is full of struggles and exhaustion. And in the end, the race leads to nowhere. The phrase rat race compares the competitive part of human work life and some of its struggles as being as pointless as the race of the rat. Leaving or quitting the rat race is the only way a person can win. Now let's hear some examples using the phrase rat race.
After being in the rat race for years and years, Steve can't wait to retire.
This rat race lifestyle is going to kill me. I don't have time to do anything I love anymore.
Chloe has no interest in joining the rat race. I think she's going to be a farmer.
One note on writing this expression. When this expression is used as an adjective, we usually put a dash between rat and race. And that is all the time we have for this Words and Their Stories. To all of our friends celebrating the Lunar New Year, happy Year of the Rat. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
Michael Sunday was very happy and a little surprised when he first saw his new right hand. It is a glove-like prosthetic device that covers his real right hand. The device should help Sunday return to a normal life after he lost three fingers in a car accident a year ago. The prosthetic feels like real skin and is dark in color. In fact, the color looks very much like that of Sunday's skin. Until now, most man-made body parts available in Nigeria have been white. Sometimes the manufacturers use wood. That also looks unrealistic. Sunday lost the thumb and fourth and fifth fingers on his right hand in 2018. He was riding in a car with his parents when it hit another vehicle. The 22-year-old student told the Reuters news agency he really likes the prosthetic device.
Wow, this is lovely. Wow, finally, I have my fingers back. Wow, amazing.
John Eminem, a Nigerian artist, made the prosthetic hand. He once made special effects for movies. He became interested in prosthetics after a family member lost a limb in an accident. Eminem said, he noticed that people who have lost arms or legs often feel uneasy around others. One reason was man-made limbs that did not have the same skin color as those wearing them.
I became emotional about the amputees. They had this feeling of discomfort whenever they were around normal people.
Eminem decided to do what he could to make amputees feel better. Although he does not have any special training in making prosthetics, he did some sculpting as an art student. He started making prosthetic fingers, hands, arms, legs, and ears in 2017. It takes 3 weeks to 2 months to make one, depending on the size and complexity of the body part. His company is called Immortal Cosmetic Art. It sells the pieces for at least 40,000 naira, or $111. To prepare Michael Sunday's hand, Eminem began as any artist would. He made a model and mixed paints, trying to find the right skin color. He says the result is lifelike.
We have prostheses who are made of white skin. You rarely find people with black skin prostheses. So I want the blacks, I want Africans in particular, to have these needs solved within Africa.
I'm Jill Robbins.
And now we present The Making of a Nation. Theodore Roosevelt became President of the United States in 1901. He firmly believed in expanding American power in the world. To do this, he wanted a strong Navy. And he wanted a way for the Navy to sail quickly between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. Roosevelt decided to build that waterway. Today, Ashley and I tell the story of the Panama Canal.
For many years, people had dreamed of building a canal across Central America to link the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. The most likely place was at the thinnest point of land, Panama. Another possible place was to the north, Nicaragua. President Roosevelt appointed a committee to decide which place would be better. Engineers said it would cost less to complete a canal that had been started in the 1880s in Panama. But the United States would have to buy the land and building rights from a French company. The price was high, more than $100 million. So the committee decided it would be less costly overall to build a canal in Nicaragua. The proposal went to the United States Congress for approval.
The House of Representatives quickly passed a bill to build the Nicaragua Canal. Then the French company reduced its price for the land and building rights in Panama. It decided some money was better than no money at all. President Roosevelt was pleased. He gave his support to the Panama Plan. When the Senate began debate, however, it appeared the Nicaragua plan would win. Then, a volcano exploded in the Caribbean area. A city was destroyed. 30,000 people were killed. Soon, reports said another volcano had become active and was threatening a town. The volcano was in Nicaragua. Nicaragua's president denied there were any active volcanoes in his country. But one of Nicaragua's postal stamps showed a picture of an exploding volcano. That little stamp weakened support for the Nicaragua Canal. The Senate passed a bill for a Panama Canal instead. The House of Representatives changed its earlier decision. It approved the Senate bill.
At that time, Panama was a state of Colombia. Canal negotiations between America and Colombia did not go smoothly. After 9 months, the United States threatened to end the talks and begin negotiations with Nicaragua. The threat worked. In January 1903, Colombia signed a treaty to permit the United States to build the Panama Canal. The treaty gave the United States a canal zone. This was a piece of land 10 kilometers wide across Panama. The United States could use the canal zone for 100 years. In exchange, it would pay Colombia $10 million, plus $250,000 a year. The United States Senate passed the treaty within 2 months. The Colombian Senate rejected it. The Colombian government demanded more money.
President Roosevelt was furious. He saw the issue in terms of world politics, not simply Colombia's sovereignty. He said, "I do not think Colombia should be permitted to bar permanently one of the future highways of civilization." Roosevelt was ready to take over Panama to build the canal. That was not necessary. A revolt was being planned in Panama to gain independence from Colombia. The United States made no promises to support the rebels, but it wanted the rebels to succeed. Under an old treaty, Colombia had given the United States the right to prevent interference with travel across Panama. Now the United States used the old treaty to prevent interference from Colombian troops. Several American warships were sent to Panama.
The local leader of the Panamanian revolt was Manuel Amador. Amador had the support of the French company that still owned the rights to build the Panama Canal. The chief representative of the company was Felipe Bunau Varilla. He worked closely with an American lawyer, William Cromwell. Bunau Varilla and Cromwell provided Manuel Amador with a Declaration of Independence, a constitution, and money. Amador used the money to buy the support of the Colombian military commander in Panama City, the capital. He also got the support of the governor, who agreed to let himself be arrested on the day of the revolt. Amador formed a small army of railroad workers and firefighters. The rebel army planned to take over Panama City on November 4th, 1903. Just before that, 500 Colombian soldiers landed at Colón, 80 kilometers away. The soldiers could not get to Panama City, however. All but one railroad car had been moved to the capital.
Manuel Amador gave a signal. The revolution began. There was a little shooting, but no one was hurt. Most of the shots were fired into the air to celebrate the call for Panama's independence. Colombian officials were arrested quickly. Then Amador made a speech. He said, "Yesterday we were slaves of Colombia. Today we are free. President Theodore Roosevelt has kept his word. Long live the Republic of Panama. Long live President Roosevelt. Colombia asked the United States to help it regain control of Panama. The United States refused. It said it would oppose any attempt by Colombia to send more forces there. The United States also recognized Panama's independence. And almost immediately, it started negotiations with the new government on a canal treaty.
The two sides reached agreement quickly. The treaty was almost the same as the one the Colombian Senate had rejected earlier. This time, however, the canal zone would be 16 kilometers wide instead of 10. And the United States would get permanent control of the canal zone. The treaty was signed on November 18, 1903. That was just 15 days after Panama declared its independence.
Colombia protested. It said the United States had acted illegally in Panama. Many American citizens protested too. They called President Roosevelt a pirate. They said he had acted shamefully. Some members of Congress questioned the administration's deal with the French Canal Company in Panama. Several investigations examined the deal. Theodore Roosevelt did not care. He was proud of his success in getting the canal started. He said, "I took the canal zone and let Congress debate. And while the debate goes on, so does work on the canal."
It took 10 years for the United States to complete the Panama Canal. The first ship passed through it in August 1914. In that same year, the United States signed an agreement with Colombia. The agreement expressed America's regret for its part in the Panamanian Revolution. And it provided a payment of $25 million to Colombia. Theodore Roosevelt was no longer president when the agreement was signed. But he still had many friends in the Senate. He got them to reject it. After Roosevelt's death, the United States signed another agreement with Colombia. The new agreement included the payment of $25 million. It did not include the statement of regret. The Senate approved the new agreement.
The issue of America's involvement in Panama caused much bitterness in other countries of Latin America. Some did not feel safe from American interference. President Roosevelt said the United States would not interfere with any nation that kept order and paid what it owed. Roosevelt was worried because some Latin American countries were having difficulty repaying loans from European banks. He did not want the issue of non-payment used as an excuse for European countries to seize new territory in the Western Hemisphere. Roosevelt said the United States was responsible for making sure the debts were paid. His policy led to further United States involvement in Latin America.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.